Hey everybody, welcome to the Spillers After Show Podcast. I'm Brian Dunn.
And I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And we are just wrapping up Spillers number 7 here in the green room at Valley Bar, Robert.
Valley Bar, same owners, different venue.
That's right.
Fantastic location. We always wanted to do a show here, so I'm glad that we finally got to. It's shaped a little bit differently than Crescent Ballroom.
Yes, it is. It's very different.
Matters. Yeah, it's kind of rectangular lengthwise instead of portrait.
Right, but we adjusted.
Or
fairly
portrait
well.
Portrait rather than landscape, I guess. Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Well, it was a great night. I mean, we had incredible readers who shared their wonderful short fiction, and one of those people is with us right now. Her name is Susan DeFreitas. She's no stranger to the Spillers After Show podcast, but now we get to actually interview her in the proper mode and manner. So welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we finally dragged you onto the Spiller stage, huh? Why did it
onto the podcast for the second time, but finally on the Spiller stage?
And she's appeared in an event book without being at the event. So I think now we're making it. Now you've got the trifecta. We're making it official.
It's very satisfying.
Is it?
You're the first Spiller's hat trick.
Yes, that's what
what? Yeah,
that's what we like to hear. Satisfying. Spiller's was satisfying. That might be our new tagline.
Fiction should be satisfying.
It should, shouldn't it? Do you find the writing of fiction satisfying? You must, because
I do, yeah.
You have your debut novel out there. It is entitled Hot Season. How has that been for you?
Oh, you know, it's been really wonderful. The book launched on November 1st, and it was such an Arizona book. You know, the book is set in a kind of a fictional version of Prescott, Arizona, where I lived for 14 years. And at a fictional version of Prescott College. So, you know, though I had been living in Portland, Oregon for about 7 years, I knew I had to come back to share it with Arizona readers. And, you know, when I lived in Arizona, I was a nonprofit arts director. I had many creative friends, but many of them, you know, performing artists and musicians. I didn't have a lot of literary friends, you know, writers and readers in my social group. So it was really fun to come back to this state and really connect to this whole other side of the arts culture here, and to connect with some folks. I would have to say I consider them literary outlaws.
Ooh.
I like that. You know, in the Southwest, we have some folks who don't quite fit the mold of literary culture necessarily from the East Coast or even, you know, up the West Coast. We have our own particular a brand of creative individuals down here in the Southwest, and I love them.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
That is so different.
Yep.
I very much want to hear an example of that. But first, I need to add a little disclaimer. Right after Spillers ended this evening, I walked out into the audience to say hi to a couple of friends, and one of them immediately said, Susan's story was incredibly Northern Arizona. And I was like, what do you mean by that? Tell me what you mean by that. And he was like, I was waiting and waiting and waiting for her to say the phrase, you don't lose your girlfriend, you just lose your turn. Have you ever heard this?
No.
Okay. Apparently, it's such a hit phrase in Flagstaff.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
That he was like half expecting it to come out. He's like, you know, and they were, both my friends were like, yeah, so a goat showing up, like that is something that happens in Northern Arizona. Like they just had you pegged geographically based purely on your story. So how much has this like outlaw literature kind of affected that, and how much has being in that part of the world affected how you write?
God, you know, that's a really interesting question because, you know, I lived in the state for 14 years and I feel like I lived such amazing stories and I knew such colorful characters that I had to write about them. But when I went back to school to do my MFA at Pacific University outside of Portland, I felt like the people, and no fault of theirs whatsoever, but they did not understand the world that I was writing about at all.
Oh, they didn't?
No, and they did not understand my characters. And they, you know, well-meaning folks, they would say, are you making fun of these people?
Oh.
And I was like, well, yeah, they're like my friends. I mean, that's...
So definitely.
Yeah. Definitely.
That's what you do.
And I think it's really, you know, and it took me a while to really arrive at my stance. And that's, you know, that is part of what you go through when you're forced to articulate, you know, what your vision is in the world. And it's this and not that. When you're a little misunderstood, you have to understand yourself clearly. Mm. And, you know, what I really began to see was that I like to write about the fringe as if it is the center, because it is the center to the people who are living in it, you know?
Right.
And I also really like the intimacy of saying, you know, I am inviting you as the reader to come into, to be part of my tribe, to be part of my world. I'm going to write to you. I'm going to speak to you as if we share certain sensibilities, mm-hmm. if we share certain life experiences, you know, and among those, you know, might be, you know, certain types of travel, certain types of appreciation for different landscapes across the American West, certain types of, you know, the kind of lifestyle where you might, you know, crash on your friend's couch in Moab, Utah, where you might know exactly the best coffee shop in Durango, where it's part of this network of people who shared outdoor experiences and are generous to one another in terms of support of each other's creative lifestyle. Yeah. And, it, you know, a little bit of an underground network of the Southwest and the West, yeah. you know? And the more I felt misunderstood, the more I wanted to write about that exact thing. And there was a certain point where it gelled. There was a certain point where I had articulated enough about each one of these characters and the different layers of where they were coming from in terms of their class, their upbringing, the region, part of the world, their values, where suddenly literary readers who had never been to the Southwest, maybe not even grown up in the West, who had no relationship to the natural world. I always like to joke about that because it's like, you don't ever leave a building. You don't apparently ever eat food. You have no relationship to the natural world.
Shouldn't the natural world just be the world?
See, that's my stance. But again, okay. I really had to explain where I was coming from to people who considered it unusual.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Whereas it was neat to come back to this part of the world where I feel very understood and very appreciated.
Well, good, yeah. good. Yeah, you should.
I deeply love this idea of putting the fringe at the center. It reminds me a little bit of kind of the mantra behind, well, not so much a mantra, but kind of the ethos, I guess, behind magical realism. Mm. Where like, you know, you put some mystical crazy element into a story and then treat it as if it's completely normal and don't comment on it at all.
Yeah.
And it's just there, you know, mm-hmm. like, cars that fly, you just don't treat that like anything is unusual about that. And I think I very much identify with authors who are probably seriously misunderstood people in their lives and who are just writing from that place. And I think there's probably a lot of cult favorite authors who work in that way too. Mm-hmm. So you were saying at some point, like you had gotten into that space, that geography and that background and those characters well enough that it kind of came to a boil where
anybody could get it.
That anybody could read it. And now they could identify with those Southwestern characters. Like what, tell us about that journey. Like what did that take to get to that point?
You know, I think because I approach political subjects in my writing, and particularly in this book, I feel like, you know, in some of the initial readings of the work, you know, some of the people who were reading it, be it teachers or peers, you know, they were putting up their defenses the way you do when you feel as if somebody is trying to sell you on their point of view. Right, politically or otherwise, charged subjects. Whereas the more that I began to craft different characters with completely different takes on the same subjects, you know, whether it's, again, Hot Season deals a lot with environmental topics, drought, wildfire, runaway development in the Southwest, you know, be it Ed Abbey or Susan Lang or John Nichols, we all write the same story, If you live in the Southwest, you fall in love with the landscape. The landscape's always threatened. It's always about water. It's always about fire. There's always some surreality to it because it's hot as heck. It's going to fry your brain. You're going to, you know.
Yeah.
There are always some hallucinations involved, I'm sure.
Right. But, you know, the more I was able to articulate, well, this character has this orientation to this subject matter, you know. I might have one character who wants to be a radical environmental activist, who really believes in like blowing up dams and setting fires and really sticking it to the man, you know.
Yeah.
Somebody else on the complete other side, you know, might think that that is a really dumb thing to do, but is also kind of paralyzed by their sense of inaction, you know, and their inability to do anything in the face of injustice. Whereas somebody in the middle, like my the protagonist, Rel, is really somebody who is moved by her conscience, but constrained by her reason, and trying to sail, like, you know, through Scylla and Charybdis there to figure out how to make a meaningful life as a young person trying to both make a living, you know, mm-hmm. drowning in debt the way so many young people are, yeah. but then also live a meaningful life. And so, you know, in having this chorus of voices speaking to these different angles, these different takes on the same subject, I felt that people were suddenly able to understand. I wasn't trying to sell them anything. No. I was really just actually trying to explore, like, what does it take? What does it mean to take meaningful action? What does it mean to live a meaningful life? And where are young people, you know, in this particular economy, you know, what are the constraints upon them and what are their most meaningful choices?
Yeah. You know? So how is it that you approach jumping into those different mindsets then? Was it just experience that you drew upon, people that you knew who espoused certain courses of action versus others? Or was there some other way that you approached that?
I think people who are constitutionally meant to be writers of fiction, we almost have like an empathetic handicap.
Empathetic handicap.
You know,
I'm not sure it's a handicap, but I like the way that you phrase that.
I mean, call it a superpower if you want, but it certainly doesn't serve you that well in life.
It certainly makes things a little more difficult.
It makes things
than
a little more difficult.
Be.
You know, you sit and you have a beer with almost anybody and listen to their point of view, and you suddenly just see it the way that they see it, and you can really understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
You know? And I had such a close-knit community of artists, activists, and conservation-minded folks in Prescott that, you know, they really did have very different takes on the same subjects, but I'd sit down with any of them and find myself completely and wholeheartedly agreeing with each one of them.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it being like, but wait a minute, you know, that action is really actually kind of extreme. Like, wait, no, that's a conspiracy theory. Yeah. That's actually kind of cowardly. You know, it's like later on when you think it through, you're like, huh, that's actually not what I believe at all. But I really felt that.
Yeah,
you know?
In the moment, it sure
really
seemed compelling.
That.
Like I was on board.
And I feel like...
Don't you feel duped later? Like the next day you talk yourself through it or someone you tell somebody else about it and then you're like, guy actually sucked.
Well, so
yeah. I just didn't realize. It.
I'm wondering, like, what's the length of time here? Where is it on the drive home? Is it the next morning?
Is it 10 years later?
Yeah,
after you've
right.
done some dumb
right,
things
right.
with
after
your
you,
life.
Yeah,
these are some burning questions.
These are burning questions.
Yeah.
So I'd imagine it's got to be like, I mean, you've had some pretty like wild experiences, I guess, that would enable you to sort of bend in and out of people's brains maybe more naturally than the average human. For example, touring the country in a gypsy school bus caravan with circus performers. I think we talked about this before.
I mean, right?
Doesn't everybody do that? But
no, Susan, not everybody does that. No. I don't think we talked about it last time.
So let me just ask this question. What the hell?
Can you define circus performers? What kind of acts are we talking about here?
You know...
Was there a sword swallower?
To me, there really isn't a good term for it. Circus arts, you know, it's easy to be derisive and dismissive of that because we think of what we think of, like Barnum and Bailey. We think of like Running Away with the Circus, whatever. But to me, honestly, I feel quite passionately about circus arts. Mm-hmm. And I did have that experience as like a young hippie coming in off Dead Tour. You know, there were a lot of what I would come to think of as underground circus acts in the late 90s who were touring the country. In all different styles and formats, from, you know, very crusty punk, you know, anarchist, fire, and revolution, to like very woo-woo, like new age, like we're going to do the living tarot. And I loved the range of that.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's all the fringe, but it's all very different. But, you know, I found later in my life, as I, in my 20s, I established a career as a arts administrator in Prescott, working for I was the executive director of a nonprofit called Tsunami on the Square. And through that organization, I established something called Circus Camp for Kids, which was a summer camp that would bring in kids from the local Big Brothers Big Sisters organization. Again, these are kids without a ton of opportunities for, you know, for many things, but especially for arts enrichment, because of course it's all cut through schools.
Yeah.
And I'd bring in, you know, very culturally and regionally and racially diverse performers for the festival itself, and have those performers teach kids circus arts. Now, something beautiful about circus arts is that Suzuki violin, you got to start that stuff when you're like 4 years old, and you might be good enough by 12 that somebody wants to see you do it, but yeah, you can learn to juggle in a day. And
so
you are awesome.
Yeah.
And I feel, especially for young people, you know, the ability to learn a skill that puts you on stage, that makes you the center of attention, that allows your community to get behind you like that. And stilt walking is the same way. Spinning poi is the same way, you know, and eventually that becomes spinning fire. So,
yeah,
again,
yeah,
you can laugh about circus arts, but I will speak the holy gospel of circus arts.
Yeah, no, I don't think anyone here is laughing about circus arts.
I think it's really special.
It's very cool.
I think it's a special kind of folk art.
Yeah, I like that. I like that way of categorizing it.
I just want to mention that I've literally never heard of Suzuki violin before.
Oh, you haven't?
Let alone realized that it took years to master it. Can someone tell me what Suzuki violin is?
Suzuki, yeah, is
the Suzuki method.
The method for learning classical violin.
Yeah.
Oh, so this isn't like a party trick. This is a style
of
violin.
No, this is your life, kid.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah.
I understand.
So do you like things like the Jim Rose... Is it the Jim Rose Circus
I
or the
love
Jim
it
Rose
all.
Freak
yes,
Show? Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, so stuff like that.
Again, that's
like
not
that
the
too.
Style of what I did.
Right.
But I love the whole range of it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that for the first time at like a Lollapalooza.
Yes, back Lollapalooza.
It was like two or three.
No, they
I think.
Really had the angle of self-harm.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it was all about chains and nipples
and
lifting
yeah,
bricks
yeah.
and
it,
things.
It was
and
very punk. Yeah. You know, and that's
all things
that's
I never
just,
expected to say on the podcast.
Yeah, well,
it's
now it's got to get slapped with a mature label.
It is very a very wide a world of circus arts, but Lollapalooza definitely had that. Jim Rose.
Yeah. Okay. So I have to share a little story here. So my family likes to watch America's Got Talent. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so my daughter, who's 10.
AGT.
AGT. Thank you. Right. Thank you, Robert. Yes. Yes.
For those of us in the know.
Absolutely. Yes. thank you for that. But, you know, they love the musical acts.
Yeah.
Right. And things like that. And so I'm watching it with them and I'm like, oh God, another musical act. Okay. I get it. Cute kid. And they're, you know, plinking on the guitar. All right. That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then they have somebody who does something like.
You're talking about Grace Vanderwall, aren't you?
Kind of. I am kind of. Sorry, Grace.
Sorry,
go. She kind of gets up there, yeah, plinks and. Yeah, okay. That's fine. But then they have somebody who comes out and like starts up a chainsaw and puts it in his mouth and balances it like with the blade in his mouth. And I say, this is fucking fantastic.
In this day and age, this is so cool
to
see something that actually astounds you.
Yes.
That.
Yes. And something that you would, like, if you're a fairly conservative person like I am, you would never once attempt, but you have such respect for people who, because my thing is I always think, what about the first time?
Yeah. How like, how did you get there?
Yes, right. Because there's
how
there's,
did you ramp up?
Yes.
To putting a chainsaw in your
right
mouth?
Because there's a chasm that must be bridged, and like that first time somebody does that, whew, you know, my hat's off to you because sure. that's a leap of faith sure. for sure. Yeah.
And you know, I love it in terms of the arts because, you know, super. I don't know. There are many great efforts that go into the accomplishment or the mastery of any art form. But somehow, you know, say with writing, you know, oh, well, you had a team of editors behind you. Oh, well, you know, you had, you know, publicity behind you. Oh, you know, you've been reviewed by so-and-so. Yeah. Somebody who is putting a chainsaw in their mouth on stage, it's just them.
It's all them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really
is. They don't
is.
Need any of that stuff. They just need to show up on a street corner and do it one time.
It's true. They had to survive until that point as wow. well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you have had a bizarre and interesting life. And I'm really glad that there are writers like you in the world putting the bizarre and the interesting at the forefront.
Yeah.
Because I think the misunderstood and the outcasts are like my favorite people in the world. And yeah. I latch on to stories about those people.
Yeah.
And I want to write stories about those people.
I love the idea of getting the fringe out there.
Yeah.
I like that and getting them some attention.
Well, you know, it's really more that I had a great and wild adventure in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And then I spent the rest of my life, you know, in many ways centering that experience into the mainstream and also, you know, finding ways to bring artists at the fringe into the center, you know. And enriching communities through the arts. So I still believe in how important that is, you know. And now that I've kind of shifted my focus to the literary arts, which was always what I loved, it was always what I was doing on the side. Mm. Even when I was traveling on the gypsy bus, I was waking up at like 6 a.m. to write fiction on top of the bus while everybody
on top
was
of the bus,
asleep.
Top of the bus.
It was the only place where I could get any privacy. We live with 13 people.
Wow.
You know, but I still really feel like, you know, some of the voices that we've heard tonight, you know, at Spillers, like. Those rising voices and their experiences, like I feel really passionately about what, you know, what you guys are doing and helping to pass it on to the next generation and to share that empathetic experience. It may not be your life experience, but right. when you hear a story, you know, told from that point of view, you suddenly have more empathy, you know. So I'm doing the same work that I was doing before with circus arts, but I'm just doing it now with literary arts.
Well, we think it's wonderful work that you're doing, and we really appreciate you being part of Spillers Number 7 and sharing your short story, Pyrophytic,
thank
with
you.
Us. And thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
And that was a great point to land on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you so much.